Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Sitting across the table is arch foodie Thea Leonarduzzi.
Am I arch? I think I'm deadly serious. Yeah,
there's an archness to you. I was going to mention I had the Nigella Marmite pasta again, but then we talked about breakfasts early on today.
Yeah.
And you have nuts and berries in a little container.
Only because they're portable.
Yes, that's your breakfast, is it?
It's not in a container. It's in a napkin or whatever I can find as I race out of the house at the crack of dawn.
It's not the crack of dawn. Is it 7 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very early.
All right. So you sit there with your napkin and have nuts and berries.
Yeah, quietly munching my nuts and berries, gazing out the window.
Yeah, that sounds lovely. sounds almost ideal. Subscribe to the TLS at the moment. If you want to, you can get 12 issues for just £6, which is a real bargain. You can sign up while that lasts. This week, we have a bumper and pretty wide-ranging show. Carl Miller is here to tell us about the fall and rise of Reddit, the sixth most popular website in the world. As with everything online, it tends to amplify all the folly and aspiration of real life. Something about as far away from Reddit as I could possibly stretch for is the Travellers Club, which is 200 years old. A.N. Wilson has written a rather bathos-laden account of it, and he's here to share some stories of a bygone era. And Imogen Russell Williams, our regular reviewer of children's fiction, looks at books that help children deal with grief, which is a lovely, if rather challenging, thing to do. Last year's centenary of the end of the First World War led to a flurry of books, and of course that included books for children. It also sparks a larger debate. How do you write about death and despair for a young audience? And that can mean addressing issues like warfare and mass slaughter, but also, perhaps pressingly, the deaths that come close to home, the inexplicable loss of parents or friends. Imogen Russell Williams, the guru of children's literature for the TLS, has been reading widely as usual. She's found some good books about the war, and some that can act as a resource for the grieving, offering distressed adults the calming certainty of a script and baffled children the reassurance of straightforward answers. She's in the studio to tell us more. Imogen, hello.
Hello. I feel I need to sound like a guru now, and I don't know what one sounds like.
Sounds a bit like that. Just like that. Let's talk about the centenary of the war. Did it prompt good children's literature or examples of it?
It certainly prompted a lot of children's literature, but I think it did. I think it did throw up some really interesting and in-depth, meaty, complex, nuanced ways of addressing something so huge. I mean, it is hard for children to get their heads around something as big and stark as this war that was supposed to be the war to end all wars. And obviously by distilling that into individual stories, it's much easier for them to get a sense of the scale of the thing as a whole.
It's harder perhaps for them, because my son is 7 and he's very familiar with the war through horrible histories,
yes,
which is sort of great historical account.
Yes.
So he knows how awful it was. But I just wonder how hard it is for them to truly empathise with someone being sent there and dying or losing a friend or losing a loved one. Is that the role of these books, do you think?
Yes, absolutely, I do. I think that, for instance, books like White Feather Which is published by Barrington Stoke. It's a hyper readable title, so it's particularly dyslexia friendly, but it's just also a fantastic novella. What it does is it provides this really strong sense of this was just a thing that happened to you, or to your mate, or to your brother, because what happens in White Feather is that a family is grieving, a mother and a son are grieving because the older brother has been killed in the war, but he hasn't been killed in battle. He's been shot as a deserter. And so they're not only labouring under this huge burden of grief, but they don't have the support of their community in their grieving, and they're isolated and shamed. And the White Feather of the title, in fact, is offered by Charlie's old school teacher to his younger brother, which just is this gut-twisting moment of cruelty. But it's also it's limpid, it's clear, it's relatably written, and it's also quite a cracking adventure story, because the protagonist realises there is more to this story than meets the eye, and he goes off and he solves the mystery, and in fact makes it clear that his brother did not deserve to die in this shameful way. And I thought just, it was a real feat to distill all of that into this very slim little book.
Should we talk about the other one that you mentioned, because I've actually read it.
Ooh, well then.
Unusually for a children's book, Hilary MacKay's The Skylark's War, which won the Costa Award for Children's Book of the Year. You were one of the judges.
I was.
And I interviewed her on Front Row, so I had to read the book as well. And it tells the tale of a family, one of whom goes to War Rupert, who is modelled on Rupert Brooke, I learned talking to the author. And it's about, but the section on the war is magnificently written with a sort of, there's a thread of poetry kind of in the prose, isn't there?
There is, absolutely. And Hilary's writing is just extraordinary. You don't realise how extraordinary it is until you finish reading the book and you realise that you've just glided through it. And yes, I would say that poetry, in fact, inheres in every part of the book. It's about the wrench and disruption and heartbreak of war, but also it's about grief and people's competence in dealing with grief as well.
And the cruelty of the dad. The mum dies and the dad is this terrible parent.
Yes, and this is the thing. You know, Clary goes through much of her life believing that she was responsible. Clary's the protagonist. She goes through much of her life believing that she was responsible for her mother's death because her mother died shortly after she was born. And her brother Peter also believes this as a young child, and so he starts out deeply resentful of this little mewling scrap who's stolen his mother from him. And all it would have taken would have been for their father to make clear that this had not in fact been the case, to save so much heartache and heartbreak, and the fact that it didn't happen, it's never sort of shoved down your throat or spelled out for you, but it's just there as this echoing waste really in the book.
And both of these first two here seem to have very developed narratives and adventures within them of going to the Western Front or wherever it is, whereas the Tony Ross book, that seems to offer a very different lesson, because it's sort of for all of the will of wanting to have a narrative and have control over what might happen and how you tell the story.
It's just, yes, the lesson there is, oh my goodness, you can have an ambition, you can even have a name, you can have an identity, which is unlike all of your little ant peers, but when war comes into the equation, everything changes, the scale changes, there is no more logic, it's just everything is obliterated and you have no control over your destiny. It is an extraordinary book. It can kind of, I sort of hate read the reviews on Amazon, because there are people who have picked it up thinking that this is going to be sort of Tony Ross on Little Princess, very gentle, very toddler friendly kind of form, and they're like, well, this is not suitable for children. And I'm like, well, yes it is, it's just not that age of child.
What age is that aimed at?
Well, I honestly think that you could read that with okay, so you need to have a sense of war and what war can do, and that might be maybe 6 and up, but it kind of depends on the child. But I think that you could look at that book with teenagers and say, what do you get from this? What do you think Ross was trying to do? What is the effect on you?
Because the problem with kids and war is they still have the sense of it being like a game, don't they? That, you know, they have, my son has Lego, and there will just be battles, and death is meaningless in that. So
yes,
you have to have something that is an antidote to that. The idea of war is just a conflict that happens without any real sense of loss.
Well, it's clear in the title of that one that it's an anti-war story.
Yes,
strong pun game.
Strong pun game, absolutely.
But he will have attracted an audience because he does David Walliams, doesn't he, as well? And The Little Princess, I can see in my mind. They're very bright colours and clear
yes.
lines.
Yes, and I mean, you know, The Little Princess titles, are sort of an example would be I Want My Potty.
That's the one I'm thinking of. Yeah. That is sadly the one I'm thinking of. That's her shouting and... There's a king in there. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I mean, they're very sweet and witty and charming takes on the idea of sort of simultaneously that every family is royalty and every family is really down to earth.
Yeah.
And they're beautiful. They work. They really do a good job for that age group. But that is much more. This is 3 to 6 classic picture book territory, and an anti-war story is not the same kind of beast at all.
Should we move on to some books which I think are still are for very young children? It's about dealing with grief. And there's almost the most important thing a book could do, I suppose, of all types of children's book, is try and explain something like the loss of a parent or a friend, because that comes from nowhere for a child. There's no context. And giving context to that experience is presumably one of the functions of literature.
Yes, absolutely. And it's quite a big ask of a book. But I think, I know from bookseller friends that it is a question that they are asked daily. What books do you have to help talk to children about grief? So yes, I'm definitely in favour of there being many and brilliant titles, and some of the ones that we've touched on in this piece are just
they're heartbreaking, aren't they?
Yes.
Only One of Me sounds gut-wrenching.
If you try to read Only One of Me as a parent, then you will cry. There's just no way past that. I cried repeatedly.
I think I would cry even not as a parent.
Yes.
It just sounds
an
incredible project.
It absolutely is. But it's just, I'm in awe of Lisa Wells. When she was diagnosed with terminal cancer, she wanted to put together a picture book to pass on to her children, but also to help other families who found themselves in this situation. And so she set up an appeal, which was responded to by Michelle Robinson, who is an established children's book writer, who is also a friend of hers, and two different illustrators. And the text that has been put together it's so very straightforward, and it's not bells and whistles at all, but it's just... this is what you want to know about if you're in that situation. If there were more of me, I would have more time to spend. I could do all of these things that I want to do with you. I could go on all of these trips, and I could get up to these daft, joyful, playful things that we've shared together all our time. But there isn't, and our time together is limited. And so instead, we're going to ask the surviving parent and the rest of the family to try and become a little bit like me, the one you're going to lose. And in the meantime, reassure you, the grieving child, it is all right to be happy sometimes. It's all right to be angry. It's all right to be sad, whatever form that sadness is going to take. And you just have to remember the fact of the parent's love.
Did you... I wonder what a child's reaction to this book would be. So, can you imagine a parent crying, an adult crying? Do you know how children respond to this type of book? Do they?
Children, I mean, just as grief is incredibly varied for adults, grief is very varied for children too. I'm sure you're familiar with kind of coming along with a book that you think is going to sort of solve everything, and the child you share it with may just respond with complete blankness, or may sort of wander off in search of cornflakes. But I think that this book goes in at a level which is needed, and then it can be returned to over and over again as well. There's another book which I haven't talked about in this piece, which, again, this is a title that will instantly make you cry. It's called Is Daddy Coming Back in a Minute? And that deals with even worse, with the sudden death of a parent. And the follow-up is called What Happened to Daddy's Body? And these are just these are brutal questions, but they are the questions that children want answers to. And they're also questions which adults on the spot find it very difficult to find answers to, because, you know, what are you going to say? Something vague about stars and the sky and you know, are we going to talk about sleep? You'll never sleep again. That's not what I want to talk about. So this kind of book is incredibly valuable.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. If you have no faith, or I mean, because it's very easy if you have a narrative yourself to put it in. But I would imagine most people now, they don't have a narrative. So if you don't believe there's an afterlife, and we'll get to afterlives in a second, then you do need help, don't you?
Yes,
because,
you do.
Because there really isn't an answer.
Well, you talk about the calming certainty of a script, which is surely what everyone needs in precisely those moments, both parent and child.
Exactly. And until this kind of awful situation arises, you may not know that you need that script. But actually, I would heartily recommend hoping never to be in need of it, but actually arming yourself ahead of time with a sense of the sort of thing that's out there.
We mentioned afterlives there because, moving away from the personal, children are endlessly fascinated with what happens next.
Yes.
The way that adults kind of are, because there's no answer. Heaven is quite an interesting concept. The concept of death and rotting and the finality excites children.
Yes.
And to pretend that children are interested in death seems to me to misunderstand them. They love it. They love talking about it and engaging with it. Do you get books here that aren't about grief? They're about just the prospect of what happens after people die. Is that a fertile ground for
absolutely
children's writing?
And yes, again, recently, so we've had the glorious The Afterlife, The Afterwards, rather, which is by A.F. Harold, who's a poet, and again, that sort of sparse assurance comes through in every line, and illustrated by Emily Gravett. And their partnership is just really, really fruitful. The sense of what might be. There's lots of white space on the pages around both text and images, and it feels as though that space that's left for a child to climb about in his or her own imagination. The Afterwards is about a child who has a dearly loved best friend. She's grown up not knowing her mum because her mum died when she was quite small, and now her best friend, Ness, has died, and she's trying to make sense of a world without Ness. And then there's a magnificently villainous uncle who does a deal so shady that it sort of makes you wince from it. And in order to get his beloved dog back, who's died, he basically shoves his niece into the afterlife in exchange for the soul of his dog.
That's a good story.
That's a good plot. Isn't it though?
Yeah.
And when she's there, she encounters Ness, and everything in the afterwards is sort of grey and increasingly glum and despondent, and she's obviously desperate to get Ness back to the land of the living. She hasn't finished being with her best friend and adventuring and laughing and getting up to all the stuff that they get up to every single day, but Ness is not so enthused. Ness is just sort of becoming more and more resigned and less there. And not to mention that it's very hard to get back through to the world of the living, because usually for a soul to pass back to the land of the living, another living soul has to remain in the afterwards.
It's kind of like an Orpheus and Eurydice kind of scenario.
Exactly, and you've got this sort of, it's like a hinterland as well. They move on, the spirits of the dead move on from the afterwards, but we don't know where they go. So it's not, again, it's not setting out an idea of having all the answers. It's not this is the final place. It's more like it's a holding space. And again, a children's imagination can climb around in there.
It seems quite a bold choice to make the afterwards, the afterworld, so kind of bleached of colour and so sad and dark.
It is, but then again, I think the idea that it's a holding space, and if we're going Greek mythology, the asphodel fields and so on, I think it's quite a resonant image, a popular image, the idea of it as sort of slightly grey and shady, and maybe you fade from there and maybe you go somewhere else to be brighter. You can kind of fill in that part of the story for yourself.
And you want honesty, don't you, in
yes.
the end? Because if you say to children, oh, there's this place that does actually definitely exist, well, at the very least, that may not be true.
Yes, exactly. I think, in fact, what The Afterwards does is in a way, give permission to children to say, we have invented this, and it's rich and terrifying and strange and glum, and you can invent what comes after if you want to.
Yeah. Imogen, what a great pleasure it is to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This week's lead piece by Carl Miller gives a detailed account of the rise and squabbling continuation of the media company Reddit, which might not mean much to you if you never really got a grip on precisely what Reddit is, figuring, or perhaps hoping, it had little bearing on your own life. So, to recap, Reddit is the front page of the internet, the sixth most popular website in the world, with 330 million active users. It's a social news website where users, called Redditors, dictate the news agenda by voting stories up or down, and where people with often very niche passions, such as hating onions, can congregate and discuss. All of which only gives us an inkling of Reddit's true significance as a kind of social testing ground, a microcosm of, to use old-fashioned terminology, the real world. Carl Miller joins us in the studio now to tell us more. Hi, Carl.
Hello.
Maybe you could start by telling us about the button, because that really seems to illustrate how Reddit works and its kind of weird power.
It does. It's the best story, I think, for really understanding Reddit if you don't know anything about Reddit. The button just appeared on April's Fool's Day. It was just a page on Reddit. It had a counter ticking down from a minute and then a button that people could press. Those were pretty much the rules. If you pressed the button once, you couldn't press it again. And once you pressed the button, a small kind of little symbol would appear by your name on Reddit with a different colour in. It was kind of one of these experiments which Reddit did where they basically almost didn't tell their community anything else. It was like this kind of canvas. They just wanted to see what would happen. 10 million clicks of the button later, the experiment was pretty much over. And over that time, basically new religions had emerged. There were theologies, philosophies, there were wars, there were alliances. There were those that were trying to keep the button going forever. There was those that were trying to destroy it to see what happened next. There were
the perps and the emeralds.
Yeah. Yeah, so the...
What do the perps do?
So the perps are people that press the button at the very beginning.
And it goes purple.
Yeah, and that was a kind of a religion which was dedicated to keeping the button going. The Emerald Council were those that pressed at the middle point. And these are people that kind of... And genuinely, there are thousands of pages of kind of essentially theology written on this. They stood for balance. They were trying to balance the different warring tribes. And the kind of most dedicated group, I'm sure there might be Redditors that will flame you for this, yeah, but the most dedicated group were the Red Guard. These are people that watched the button for hours and hours on end and waited to try and press it in the last 11 seconds or so. And then you got a kind of really coveted little red kind of shoulder flash on
so
your...
So how did it work? So the button's there. Were you competing to see... Could you all press at the same time, or could only one person?
Only one person could press it at any point, right? And then the counter would just reset. Yeah.
So if you press at the same time as someone else, they might have pressed it rather than you.
Yeah, and it would just reset, and then the page would reset, and it would begin again.
You only get to do it once, one person.
Once you've clicked,
one click. That's it.
And are people using this kind of social internet irony? Is it just people a bit Dungeons and Dragonsy? They're trying to sort of find another world to invent theology around. What's the motivation? Because would you do that? Would you click?
It's a lot like kind of most of Reddit generally, which is that it's partly tongue in cheek,
yeah,
but it's also genuinely meaningful to the people that do it, and you know, you become mired in it. I think I remember watching the button experiment unfold and seeing these kind of you know, narratives and groups forming in ways which like genuinely meant something to the people in it, and that I think really encapsulates Reddit in a single button click, as it were. It's a culture factory.
And are they satirizing? I mean, presumably it's satirizing religion. At some level, is people arbitrarily gathering, not even necessarily religion, but society generally, people arbitrarily collecting into different tribes, even though it's meaningless ultimately, but they've attributed meaning to something, and they are setting themselves up against other people who have attributed other meanings to it also without cause. That seems to be a sort of quite prolonged absurdist satire of human society.
Well, I think ultimately many tribes are in a kind of absolute sense meaningless.
Yeah, exactly.
But certainly meaningful.
Arbitrary,
but meaningful to the people that are in them. And actually there I don't see much difference between the Perps and the Emerald Council and lots of different tribes which we form ourselves into in society.
Yeah. So is it trying to be a satirical pastiche of real society there, do you think?
I'm sure there were satirists and pastiches in there, but I think it actually went beyond that. It wasn't just a kind of satire of the offline world. I think for the many people that did it, I think it was actually meaningful in and of itself.
So they were genuinely feeling part of a tribe, of whatever thing they aligned to, and that gave them genuine meaning.
And that is Reddit. The Reddit is the ability to generate and form these kind of online subcultures in that way, and that's what makes it such an exciting place, because it's kind of doing so at a rate I think that we've just never seen before. Culture generally is something which we regard to kind of rise and fall and change on quite a kind of glacial or epochal scale, and suddenly with Reddit we're seeing it happen almost like it's in kind of fast forward.
Yeah. Well, that in a sense, I mean, it very much sounds like something that was created as a social experiment. But I mean, what was the context of its foundation? Because your piece is pegged to a book which
Indeed.
Is about what's it called? It's called "We Are the Nerds: The Birth and Tumultuous Rise of Reddit, the Internet's Culture Laboratory." So that's a kind of a biography of Reddit. Tell it. What was the foundation of this company? What was it conceived to do?
So yeah, and this is what the book essentially begins with. This it's the kind of early noughties. The two main founders, Steve Huffman and Alexis Ohanian, kind of meet, as most of the tech founders do, on some campus in America, and they kind of come up with this idea that there should be a different way in which information could be created. So they began it really as quite a simple, crude website where people could just source and share links from elsewhere on the internet, which you could essentially up or down vote. They thought that this would be a better way, especially because most of the early users were essentially power users, their kind of friends in the kind of VC and tech communities across the States, of sourcing content. And this was especially content around technology and games and online culture and things like that. That's really what it was. It was simple.
So not to make money?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was no advertising in the model, for example.
There wasn't. And Reddit struggled to make money for a very long time, and that's actually consistent with lots of the tech companies as well. The kind of money is just considered almost this kind of, you know, slightly kind of dirty question which you deal with later.
If you get an audience, eventually the theory is you'll be able to make money.
The holy grail is growth.
Yeah.
Get growth, get users, and you will find a way of making money later on.
Which is kind of what Amazon have done, ultimately. Amazon didn't make money for years and years. They just kept growing and growing and growing and growing. Netflix is still doing that.
Uber, Facebook, Twitter.
Snapchat.
It's all about growth. And, you know, and in that way, this book, We Are the Nerds, and the story that it tells of Reddit is actually a kind of very interesting insight more generally into the kind of culture and thinking of Silicon Valley. And, you know, right at this kind of golden moment, this collection of people, and it's not just Ohanian and Huffman, the many others which have kind of walk-on parts in the book are some of the most important kind of architects of the digital world in which we now live. And you get a kind of insight into the very early part of that, you know, before they were all multi-billionaire, kind of famous, kind of world-striding visionaries. These are just a bunch of, you know, driven, risk-taking, kind of technopreneur kind of students, you know, all basically embarking on this crazy journey together. And it's one where they're all trying to build platforms that will grow and kind of gobble up the world and all of us.
And this becomes exceedingly interesting, I would say, when that world there clashes with the conventional old world. So, you know, old media, and it's bought by Condé Nast in, is it 2006?
Indeed, yeah. And this was, I suppose, another thread is of the old world of publishing desperately trying to co-opt and emulate in a sense the successes that they see happening with sites like Reddit and Dig and many other social publishing sites. There's a kind of big tension between them, and both Huffman and Ohanian, in fact, some way towards the end of the beginning of the book, kind of leave Reddit as they kind of chafe with both each other and with their new corporate owners.
Because the principle of the corporation wants to say, here's a massive audience, we want to sell things to it, and the principles of Reddit, which is why it became popular, was there is no top-down direction at all. Redditors, people in the community, are choosing whatever they want to talk about, whatever they want to upvote, whatever they want to celebrate. That can't be directed by a corporate machine selling advertising, because it defeats the whole point of the site to begin with.
Indeed. So monetization is one of the tensions that kind of go throughout Reddit's life. And the other one is editorial control. I mean, Condé Nast, as any publishing organisation, is used to essentially controlling the content which, within the properties which they own, are legally responsible for. And you can kind of feel the kind of terror, really, that Condé Nast and the kind of various old guard of the publishing world begin to feel when they realise that what they've really bought here isn't a website, it's a series of communities. And communities that are very willing throughout Reddit's life to muscularly push back and assert that they are the ones that really control the platform. I mean, there's almost a kind of Frankenstein moment at one part of the book where essentially Reddit users hack Sears's website and start writing silly things across it, and Condé Nast clears that content off, and then Reddit kind of goes into revolt in response. There's a Frankenstein moment where they basically realise that they can't control this thing which they've created, and it kind of begins to snowball and freewheel more and more and more and more, and becomes more and more uncontrollable.
And the outrage is certainly something that I think most people associate with Reddit. So we should talk about that. And
yeah, is it a me? I mean, because at one level, this sounds very utopian, a bunch of nice people gathering together, collecting around their shared interests. Sounds like a bit.
Reddit is known for.
It sounds like a lovely thing. But does it also, like so many things on the internet, then become toxic by virtue of people using that opportunity to not be nice about their fellow human being, but to be mean?
Yeah, toxic sludge is the way the author actually describes it. And indeed, the kind of story begins to take a kind of much darker turn. As the subreddits, kind of these are the communities within Reddit, kind of expand and multiply, Reddit goes on to the kind of sharp end of the debates around free speech versus hate on the internet. And it kind of becomes host of these kind of whole underlayer of websites which become exceedingly problematic. Everything from the subreddits dedicated to kind of notions of genetic superiority, to ones dedicated to hate towards a particular community, to ones which are sexualizing children. They're all there on Reddit. And because the community in general is so kind of muscular, and ability to throw its weight around is so great, and its kind of commitment to kind of anti-censorship, to use air quotes, is so strong, the company founders and really, really struggles to bring these things under control. Not one but two CEOs after Ohanian and Huffman leave are taken as scalps by the Reddit community, and it's only then when the founders actually return that they can begin to bring this community back under control.
But you can never really control it, because at some level this is the test of what we believe absolute free speech should be. Should free speech be absolute? And no one really thinks it should be, but you can get into this game, particularly in this world, and believing that it is. If people want to say things about children or about communities, we might not agree with it, but we believe absolutely in free speech. That is an article of faith for some people, isn't it?
Indeed. And so Ellen Powell, the one of these departed CEOs, she only tried to shut down subreddits that were calling for or glorifying violence towards a particular group. That is a pretty low bar by anyone's standards. They weren't touching anything to do with genetic superiority. They weren't touching anything to do with all the, you know, large are the number of indecent ways in which many subreddits were then acting. It was just that, and you know, the hundreds of subreddits closed down, bounties are put on her head, her faces memed onto pictures of Chairman Mao and Hitler. You're right, and there was, I think, around the time that Reddit was struggling with this, a very kind of absolute commitment to free speech amongst online communities. I think they saw that as the kind of thin end of the wedge when it came to kind of state control and corporate control onto their freewheeling spaces.
And then Huffman and Ohanian came back. So after the kind of the friction over the Condé Nast buying them, they came back, and now they are flexing muscles and they are sort of seeking to control the communities. How does that work? Presumably it's a losing battle.
So, indeed. So they come back and they try and deal with probably the two big problems that Reddit had. The first is Huffman, who then the CEO, kind of directly challenges the community and tries to bring it under control. They don't draw hard lines in the sand, but they begin to make kind of better definition around what they would allow and what they wouldn't allow on the platform. And actually, at least from Ligorio Chavkin's telling of it, actually do so with large degree of success. They shut down lots of the subreddits, they clear away the toxic sludge, as it were, with kind of little response from the community. And then Ohanian goes around making the money. He kind of is the kind of showman to Huffman's kind of arch coder, and he goes around kind of making big deals with advertisers and starts to find new ways of Reddit making money.
And does it make money now?
I'm actually not sure now.
No one knows these things. It's a fascinating thing about the online world. You imagine they all must do, and then it's not always clear that they do.
It's not, but they definitely, in the kind of telling of this story, start making a lot more money. They kind of clear out of the red and actually become kind of self-sufficient or sustainable as a company again.
But we don't know how much that translates to profitability.
We don't. We know that Ohanian and Huffman are exceedingly rich individuals.
Because the company will be valued. Did it launch? Is it IPO'd or is it... I don't think it has.
I don't think so.
No, so at some point they'll become even richer individuals, you might imagine.
But also very famous. And this is the kind of strange kind of character of the Silicon Valley kind of CEOs, as opposed to any other, is that they're not just seen as kind of business leaders. They're actually seen as kind of visionaries.
Yeah.
Kind of people that can look into the future and tell what the world is like. Demigods, yeah. And so they become kind of famous in their own right, kind of celebrities, especially Ohanian, who kind of, I suppose, then kind of build kind of broader stages to start talking about the problems which Reddit specifically faced.
But what's its legacy really now? So it's gone, it's had its slightly tortuous growth and rise and fall and rise again. What is it now? I mean, and where does it go next? Because if it's just an aggregation place for a community, that's lovely. Is that what it is? That this is kind of, we've reached peak Reddit now, do you feel? It's impossible to say, maybe you don't know what...
I think kind of Reddit, probably like most tech companies, are on this kind of long, slow road to social decency. You know, they are being politically embarrassed. They are being and will likely be more intensively regulated in the years to come. So I think Reddit has certainly departed from their kind of absolutist free speech kind of background. They no longer see those subreddits as being part of what Reddit's about.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that Reddit will become this kind of mainstream cultural factory. Fine if you're, you know, into botany or even politics.
Yeah, Obama did an AMA, didn't he?
He did too.
And the Donald is the most important kind of focus point for the alt-right and pro-Trump communities online. It kind of bleeds over with 4chan, but it, you know, Reddit is
quite. There's lots of pro-Trump aspects of Reddit.
Absolutely,
very
yes.
It's been called a kind of a what's it, a recruitment ground for the alt-right, hasn't it?
It's probably the largest, most kind of vigorous gathering place for the alt-right on the internet, which is saying something.
And that's one of the changes, isn't it? Because historically, and this is true, I think, probably originally of Facebook as well, and Twitter, they always seem to skew left or skew liberal because of the ideals of free speech that often came in their founding. But then they've been co-opted by the right, and that's presumably the same thing that's happened to Reddit then.
Indeed, yeah. But the kind of very nasty kind of parts of both right, left and all other nasty ideologies that kind of lurk on the margins, they've kind of been pushed off Reddit and are now kind of setting up new kind of shops in the alt tech world.
Because the argument now is that deplatforming is possible to deal with it. So Alex Jones, the idiot who does InfoWars, was kicked off iTunes, wasn't he?
And Twitter.
Milo Yiannopoulos was kicked off Twitter, possibly Facebook, maybe he's still on Facebook. But and you've seen it has a massive effect on their fortunes. Milo Yiannopoulos massively in debt. Alex Jones, he feels less culturally resonant than he did before because he can't be found. So there is power here, isn't there? That ultimately, if Reddit kicks people off, if Facebook kicks people off, it's possible for people to be marginalised in a way. Now, whether that's a good or bad thing for free discourse is a different question, but it is a powerful tool that, can be used.
Yeah, and that's the kind of part of the kind of debate around free speech, which we actually don't hear much from the platforms themselves on. They're quite keen to talk about the policies and rules governing their users, much less that they now make, as you've just said, like unbelievably important decisions themselves about the, what the nature of these free and open spaces should be like. I mean, Reddit was never an enormous company. I mean, it had probably at its height several hundred employees with some others scattered around, you know, many of which were under, I mean, actually getting PTSD as the author writes. Never a huge company, but making huge decisions all the time. Often this kind of grey, murky area where it's actually not clear what the decision should be and where we've always relied on the kind of messy business of politics to try and form some kind of compromise for us. And with Reddit, actually, you know, this was a company, as it is with Facebook or Twitter or any other, actually drawing those lines. So there's another aspect of free speech and Reddit's rise and fall and then rise again, which is interesting, which is really at the heart of this enormous kind of array of different communities is actually a reasonably small number of people
exercising
power, which I think we're not really used to any private company really holding.
Watch this space, because that's going to carry on, isn't it? That's the way things are going.
I think so, absolutely. Yeah, I think we're living through the tech lash at the moment, as they now call it, a kind of swing of authors and writers and journalists.
Think about the word tech is. It can be interpolated into almost any word, can't it, to create a new coin.
It's very useful for writers like me, actually.
Yeah, how do you do entrepreneur with tech?
Oh, technopreneur. No, I was just thinking on my feet for that.
Is that new?
That might be a coinage.
Oh, technopreneur. Well, yeah, okay.
You heard it first.
Trademark that. Carmela, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
The Travellers Club has been around for 200 years and is marking its bicentennial with a history reviewed this week by one of its members, A.N. Wilson. The club began soon after the Napoleonic Wars, founded by men looking to gather in a less political setting than many of the existing London clubs. Since then, according to Andrew, its story becomes the history in miniature of Britain itself. This is particularly true perhaps in the sense that it was once grand and central in the scheme of things and is now a shadow of its former self, uncertain of its place in the world. One of the Travellers' former chairmen believes that the Gentlemen's Club does have a future into the next century. "We are a very conservative country," he said. Do we believe that? And is there really a place for single-sex institutions trading on prior glories in modern Britain? These are the questions posed by A.N. Wilson this week, and he joins us in the studio to try and answer them. Andrew, hello.
Hello there.
Now, this might be unfair, but when I think of gentlemen's clubs, yes, I kind of think of men snoozing before a fire riddled with gout.
Yes, I mean, that's if you actually know what they are at all.
Yeah.
Because most people hearing the word gentleman's club think it means a sleazy place.
Like a strip club.
Strip joint.
But I think of... I think
pole dancing.
It's kind of the complete opposite, in a sense. It's the
opposite. Yeah, no women at all. Yeah.
There aren't even boys pole dancing. No.
Yeah. What sort of club is this? But is that fair?
I mean, I think it's perfectly fair. And, I mean, the fact... When I read this book, which is a brilliant book written by an architectural historian, but he's brought in all the social history of the club and he tells you about the lives of the club servants in the 19th century, which was just awful, actually.
Oh, really?
Yes, because they were all being had up by the police all the time, and he seems a little bit baffled about why this is, but they obviously weren't bloody paid enough.
No. But you say here that one of the things about the club was the people were boring, but the staff were nice. So the staff were kind of...
I said that about them now.
Oh, really? but not so much back in the 19th century.
I'm not sure about them in the 19th century.
But
I mean, what this book shows you is that here's this institution. Most people listening to this won't even know what a club is, really. It was started for people who didn't want to come back to London when they'd been travelling. They were all aristocrats. And get involved with either a Tory club or a Whig club or... left or right, whatever you
call it. So this is the age of whites and boodles,
yes,
and things
exactly.
like that.
And instead they just wanted to have a place where they could play whist, have a good time. But little by little by little, because they were the poshocracy of England and they were absolutely running the show, in a way more than at any time in history, it became a kind of hub. Four of the Victorian prime ministers belonged to this place. Stuff got done here. The people people discussed the future of the world here.
Yeah, there's a line, in the book, the Crimean War is quite a traveller's effort.
Well, it was. I mean, the Russian all the ambassadors in London de facto belonged to the travellers. The Russian ambassador belonged to it. All the characters who were taking part in the Charge of the Light Brigade were volleying and thundering in the club before they set out on their ridiculous war. That it really was, Lord Aberdeen belonged to it, Lord Palmerston belonged to it. They were all fighting that war before it even started in the smoking room of this club.
And what attracted you to it?
Have a flat. I couldn't have afforded a flat on the wages I was getting as a journalist in London when I started out in my late 20s. And then someone said, not at all an aristocrat or indeed much of a traveller, another journalist, why don't you belong to this place? It's much cheaper than staying in a hotel. It's much cheaper than having a flat. And I joined.
So
You should stay there for about 60 or 70 pounds a night, which of course was much. And also you had this wonderful library, which in those days, now it's always used for functions, so you can't get into the bloody place. But in those days it was completely deserted, and there were just a few rather sad John le Carré-like spies hovering about in the bar.
And it was
very smelly in those days. The paint was peeling off the walls, and the membership was plummeting. It was like the Church of England, which I suppose is one of the reasons I quite liked it. But it seemed to be an absolutely no hope place. And then now look at it; it's absolutely bursting with launch parties in the evenings. And
well, but before we get on to the relaunch, let's talk about the decline. How do we account for that? Was it a sort of 1910 the character changed sort of thing?
It changed, exactly. And that's what this book really well describes, because in the 19th century it was all the stuff I've described. And there's a wonderful story which Harold Nicholson tells in one of his books, he was a member of it, that he looked across the garden and was told by his boss in the Foreign Office, "You may think we've declared war against Germany today, but actually it was all done in the wrong way. You've got to nip across the yard and get into the German embassy and spot the letters around it. It's like a sort of Bertie Wooster."
So how have they got it wrong? You told this story.
He doesn't explain, but it wasn't... The form of words was wrong, and so actually we weren't at war with Germany.
Guess they made a mistake.
And he gets into the German ambassador's bedroom and spots the letters around. It is like Bertie Wooster.
It's anyway, a brilliant... He was admitted
alternative
to the,
history.
He was admitted to the presence of the nightcap-adorned Prince Lichnowsky, who assumed the youth had come in a social capacity to express regrets that the war had interrupted their association. And then there's the declaration of war was sitting on a side table, and he swiped it.
It was on his bedroom bedside table.
And he put the correct one in. And,
exactly.
And we then proceeded to war.
And the rest was history. Well, I think the answer to your question is why it declined. All those poshos either got killed in the First World War or, in a way, gave up this type of club. They had their own, like Whites and Boodles and things, which were around the corner. This became a preserve of the Foreign Office, and it's still, in a way, the canteen of the Foreign Office, and that's what it was. But little by little by little, as described by the fact that even I was allowed to join it as a sort of hack, lower middle class, it's entirely lost any of its cachet.
It made me sad when you said that, Andrew. I'm acutely aware of the fact that if the club admitted someone like me, it had ceased to be what it was in the days of Palmerston and Aberdeen.
Exactly. No, of course it had. It had ceased to have any function at all when I joined it, except as a canteen for some old-fashioned members of the Foreign Office. Then, just at the point where it seemed as though it was going to have to close, it got a new club secretary, and it was basically revamped as a kind of hotel.
But it can't... Let's talk about the question of the single-sex aspect of it, because when we talk about the relevance today, it makes it just seem silly, doesn't it?
Completely silly. I mean, the Reform Club, which is next door, which is the great liberal club of the 19th century, that went mixed about 20 years ago. The Athenaeum, which is where all the professors and bishops and things used to belong, I don't know if they still do, that went mixed about 25 years ago.
The Garrick's holding
out,
isn't it?
Isn't,
the Garrick held out. The Travellers ought to be mixed because, as I say, half the ambassadors in London are now women, and all the ambassadors technically belong to it, so there are, let's say, 100 women who belong to the Travellers.
So they're sort of talking themselves into irrelevance.
Well, if they don't exist.
Yes.
So why don't they? What's the thinking?
They're on the verge of doing so, I would guess, yes.
Because
I don't sit on their committees, but I would think that it's within 5 years that it will be mixed. But there are some clubs, both for women and men, that don't admit members of the opposite sex, and I don't see why they should have to in terms of the law. But you're right to say it makes
sense. No, I'm not.
If it's a meeting place for diplomats, members of the Foreign Office...
Exactly.
Yeah.
If it's a place where... sort of professional people are meeting, It's obviously completely ludicrous that it should be one gender.
Are you attracted to, one of the things that struck me about reading the piece, Andrew, that the history weighs heavily while you're there?
I felt it even more when I first joined, partly because I was much younger, felt quite shy going into the place, partly because so little had been done to it, so that you really were holding the very rail on the steps, the staircase, which Talleyrand used to hold on to when he was staggering up the stairs.
Yeah.
And there definitely is a feeling of the past, which I like about London. I mean, that's one of the things you get wondering about London, wherever you may be.
There's an amazing quote, I can't remember, by Trevelyan, I think, which is about the beauty of living in Britain, which is that almost every footstep you take anywhere is a footstep that your predecessors, very different in their lives, have had. And you can't escape history.
Now the Travellers Club has been done up beautifully and looks lovely, and you can stay there. And I mean, whether you belong to it or not, women can stay there and all that sort of thing. They can eat their breakfast.
Scandalous.
It's fine, but it isn't quite what it was, and it's now just like a kind of hotel, which has a membership list.
And does it stand as a kind of metonymy for Britain? Because back in the 19th century, Britain was ruling the waves, and these Victorian figures were deciding the fates of nations and the fates of millions of people.
Yes.
And now it's a hotel, and we don't quite know its place in the world. And, you know, I don't want to raise the spectre of Brexit, but if you do a course of foreign influence...
The metaphor you're describing leads inexorably to the word Brexit somehow. I mean, needless to say, most members of the Travellers Club, being Foreign Office, were passionately against Brexit. But it is like a kind of metaphor, as Brexit itself is, for what's happened. Namely, this country has been completely marginalised in the world.
Yeah, and even, I mean...
And the other thing it shows is, obviously, you can't govern a country by having a special class like Plato's guardians, which you used to have. They were sent to public schools or sent to the Foreign Office. That's all gone. But what we haven't got, because we haven't got Plato, there's no particular reason why anybody should enter public life who is talented. Nowadays, a talented person would be working on the TLS or going into the city or being a teacher or a doctor.
Yeah.
There's no reason why they would join the House of Commons.
It's such a good point. I mean, when Ruth Davidson gave an interview, the Scottish leader of the Tories, and said, I wouldn't want to be Prime Minister, and it was kind of front page news, but I wouldn't want to be Prime Minister. Would you want to be Prime Minister?
I wouldn't want to be Prime Minister now.
Well, no, I mean, what? I mean, every day you think, why does Theresa May...
Morons and lunatics obeying at you, whatever you said or did.
But the problem is that we haven't come up with the answer to that, then, have we? Because it used to be based on birth and you know...
And education, though.
Yeah,
I mean, that was the saving thing.
The two connected,
but the saving thing about this country, unlike pre-revolutionary France, was if you're clever, you should get on. And
is that always the case?
Well, obviously not always the case even now.
No, certainly not now.
But it certainly was the case, yes. And particularly in terms of academic life, the professions and so on. You could reel off dozens of examples. Obviously, when you got to the higher edge of things, and those clever people's grandchildren had then made themselves into earls or marquises or something, then there would be a lot of snobbery coming in. But in terms of education, you could get into the professions which would lead into political life within a couple of generations.
So do you think there was genuine talent there?
Yeah.
And that talent's not there now?
No. The politicians now are not so clever as the Victorian politicians. Otherwise, we wouldn't have bloody Brexit or lots of other things you can mention.
Do you think?
Well, look at the... I mean, all right... Well,
the Victorians
did
their fair share of cataclysms, didn't they?
Oh, yes, they did. But don't go back so far as the Victorians. Think of the Labour Party, which used to have Michael Foote, who wrote quite good books.
Yeah,
that was a clever man. Always to be seen rummaging about in second-hand bookshops of Charing Cross Road. Roy Jenkins, ditto, though he was the opposite end of the Labour Party. Yeah. Dennis Healey, a very cultivated person. Where are they now? Where are the Tory equivalents?
And do we want... I mean, does being bookish matter when it comes to...
Yes, because it leads to wisdom, it leads to historical sense, it leads to lots of things. And it leads to a rounded, humane... personality.
And what's fascinating, I think, about the mess we're in, which we can link largely to David Cameron in lots of respects.
Certainly.
He's a member of an entitled class who went to Eton and felt he could become Prime Minister
because he had
that sort of background, which is not so far removed from the 19th century, except in talent terms, and exactly. possibly in terms of the quality of knowledge.
It is talent, and if you think of Boris too, because he knows about six words of Latin, everyone thinks he's a genius.
Jacob Rees-Mogg is the other one.
And Jacob Rees-Mogg, well, we didn't get onto that. But.
Well, we do. I think we should, because to me, they're examples, I'm interested, because they're kind of
they're examples of a bargain basement poshocracy, aren't they?
Yeah, but, and what frustrates me about Brexit is they say things like, they use needless Oraton metaphors to pretend that they're clever.
It's just posturing.
It's exactly right, though. It's posturing. And they'll say this is the worst treaty since the 1115 Treaty of Lyon.
Exactly.
Like that.
You're
like, oh, for fuck's sake. Don't
you think, well, if I can't tell you what that treaty is, that must mean that you are cleverer than I, so you've won and I'll back down.
Yeah.
No, that's nauseating.
It is nauseating. Now, I want to check one story, Andrew, because this suspiciously doesn't sound true. I don't want to impugn you.
Dear, you should have
put... I should have put you on
water.
Okay, someone died at the long central table in the coffee room once when I was having dinner at the Travellers, an event that remained unobserved. He was offered some Stilton at the end of the
and
meal.
And if it isn't true, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
It's a fantastic
that
story.
Is absolutely true. I was having dinner with some friends, and one of them said, I know this is the most boring bloody place in London, but somebody over there has died of boredom. And it was true.
He died and didn't notice until someone.
He was one of those people who sat at the table. Propping himself up, not by putting his hands, but by putting his wrists against the table.
Yeah.
And try it next time you die, because it keeps you upright. And I felt extremely sorry for the head waiter, because he had to go round sort of quietly telling us. And he said, Sir X, he was a lawyer, I'm afraid he's been taken ill. It was obvious he was dead. I mean, he's as white as the paper. and then a woman who was having dinner, who was a doctor, came over and laid him out on the carpet. Yeah, it really did happen.
Did you not clear out of the room?
Yes, everyone cleared
everyone
out.
Cleared out. Okay, good.
No, everyone cleared out.
The British thing to do would be
carry
to
on,
continue.
Carry on.
Some hooray Henrys at the end were shouting out, we haven't finished our dinner yet.
See, it's very hard to remain angry at the concept of the Travellers Club or any other club, because it just feels
but
rather...
But the point about it is it's standoffish. I mean, it's not like the Garrick, which is trying to flash Harry's club, where everyone's standing one another drinks in the bar and so on. It's pinched and unhappy, and it's for repressed homosexuals in the Foreign Office, really. That's what it's for now, or was. But now, it's as I say, it's... Sort of
sure, they'll include that in their marketing.
If you're a repressed gay person,
but that's what it used to be. Anyway.
It reminds me a bit of the Diogenes Club, which is
The Diogenes is based on it.
Is that right?
And when you join, I mean, when you joined in my day, they said you can belong to it, old boy, but the thing is, we don't talk to one another.
Yeah. Do you know about the Diogenes here? So Sherlock Holmes's brother, Mycroft.
Oh yes, no, I do. Yeah,
he sits
Mycroft
in a club,
Holmes.
and if you speak, if you speak. In certain rooms, you're blackballed from a club for eternity, aren't you? You're asked to leave. And so that's modelled on the Travellers,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, it is. There's a nice room where people chat and there are magazines and it's mixed. But then there's a smoking room where obviously you're not allowed to smoke anymore. Which is still exactly as it was when Mycroft Holmes was sitting there not talking to anybody. Bliss.
Yeah. Andrew, thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Imogen Russell-Williams, Carl Miller and Andrew Wilson. Make sure you get your hands on the paper this week. It really does cover a lot of ground, as might be suggested by this podcast. Next week, we look, among other things, at the North, Thea.
Hello.
Your spiritual home.
Yes.
You'll be bringing your whippet in especially.
I'm actually trying to get one.
You're not serious?
Not especially for the occasion, but I am trying to acquire a dog.
Are you?
I am.
Oh, yeah, amazing.
Had a home check today.
What is it?
Well, they have to check whether you're, you know...
Do they?
...allowed to have a dog.
I got a dog without that.
Yeah, but did you buy it or did you take it from a rescue centre?
Oh, I bought one.
Oh, there you go.
So you're...
judging you now.
Oh, really? Well, I've got young, very young kids, so I was trying to get a puppy.
One without trauma.
Yeah. So what are you going to get? This is amazing.
Whatever's going, really. Very excited about it.
When will it come?
Don't know.
Oh, how brilliant.
Updates to follow.
Oh, great. Well, there you go. Well, we won't be talking about dogs next week. We'll be talking about the North. So that's lovely. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.